It's Wednesday, October 27th, 2010. This is Wendy Erickson. I'm a reference librarian at the Parchment Community Library. And today, I am taking the oral history of Jim Crow. C-R-O-W-E. Jim, what is your full name?
My full name is James Douglas Crow.
And when and where were you born?
I was born in Kalamazoo on October 22nd, 1947.
Okay. And where do you live today?
Today I live just outside of Matawan.
All right. And what is your personal connection to the Parchment area?
I never lived in Parchment, but I worked at the mill, which had various names, for about 27 years.
Okay. When did you start there?
I started in March of 74 when it was Brown Company.
Okay, and what's the first, how'd you get in there? How'd you get hired?
I just went down and put an application in, and they called me back like a week later and said, can you come down and take a physical today?
Sure.
And actually, I took a physical at 10:30 in the morning, and I started working at 3 o'clock in the afternoon the same day on a Monday.
Yeah.
They were slow, you know, and they needed people, or, you know, they were busy at the mill, and yeah, they needed people to fill for vacations and stuff.
I see. Had you worked, did you come straight out of high school, or?
No, out of high school, I worked at a grocery store for about a year as a stocker. Then I spent a little over 3 years in the Army, another year and a half at the grocery store, and then 3 years driving truck for the old BMO potato chip company.
Oh, yeah.
And I got irritated with them over some things, so I quit and worked. While I was looking for a job, I worked for Charles Service Security Service for 3 months, and I was putting applications in all over, and Brown Company was the first one that called me back of the applications that I put in.
I see. Okay.
So I went down ready to work and got hired.
Got hired. What's the first job you had at the mill?
I started out in Mill 2 in the beater room, the bottom job in seniority there, which was called Brokeman. That's the guy that gets to pick up all the junk underneath the big paper machines when they're running.
Okay.
You know, when the paper machine's running, it's running at like 1,600 feet per minute.
Sure.
And if the paper breaks, they don't shut it down. They just funnel the paper through a slit in the floor down into the basement. And in 2 minutes' time, they can put an awful lot of paper down there.
And I see.
When I did the job, there were two guys down there, and you picked all that stuff up by hand, and you carried it over to, they had what was basically a old-fashioned style farm hay baler. And you put it into that, and you made paper bales the size of a hay bale, and if it was stuff you couldn't recycle, you stacked those bales up on skids and hauled them away. If it was stuff that they could recycle, they had carts there that you put it into and then hauled it back up to the beater room.
Sure. How long did you do that?
Let's see, March. Not quite a year, because they were working what they called four crew in the machine room and beater room. And I started in March. The following January, they dropped from four crew down to three crew, which bumped me out of the beater room. And I worked on two or three different jobs for a week here and there, and then I got laid off for 3 months.
Ah, yes.
And after that was the only time I was ever laid off for any period of time. I came back to work, and I started working at the Rewinders down at Mill 1, and I stayed there for quite a number of years.
Okay. How'd you like that?
I liked Rewinders real well. That was a good job. You know,
it was
not quite as, the broke job I didn't like. I mean, you went in there and killed yourself. Sometimes you never sat down for 8 hours. It was extremely hot, humid,
yeah.
You know, heavy, nasty work, you know, which, you know, frequently in a big mill, you know, there are jobs that are like that. And when you're brand new, that's what you do.
Right.
And,
that's right.
And Rewinders, I was a helper, you know, on a machine. They'd have an operator that ran it and a helper that would help him load it and all that. And then the product that came out the front,
okay,
you boxed it up. You know,
okay.
So, you know,
I see.
It's considerably, you know, you're still busy, but considerably easier job.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you work a swing shift there?
I worked everything, the way the Rewinders worked, different departments were different. Rewinders, they had a fixed midnight shift, and then days and second shift swing. Some departments, like the beater room and machine room, they swang all three shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Some like finishing, they were fixed shifts. So when I was working in Winders, I started there. First 4 years I worked midnights, And then when there was an opening onto the day 3 to 11 swing, you know, I signed that opening. And so then I worked days in 3 to 11 for a number of years until things, they started, you know, things got slower and I got bumped out and worked a number of jobs for just short periods. And then I ended up at Mill 2 Finishing.
Ah, Mill 2 Finishing. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you like that?
Yep.
Yes?
Yes, I did. Up there, I started off up there training as a trimmer operator. I did that for about a year, and they were only running a single shift. Then they decided that they wanted to run a second shift, and I had a backup posting as a tractor driver. So I signed the posting for a second shift, and nobody else wanted to work it, so I got to be forklift driver on the second shift, you know, and mm-hmm. I'd bring loads of stock up and haul, you know, loads of finished boxes away and that kind of stuff. So,
okay.
You know, again, you're busy, but, you know, the forklift does all the work.
Sure.
You know,
so right.
I really liked that. That was good.
Did you ever load the railroad cars, the box cars?
I never loaded them. One of the times when, you know, when things were slow and I got bumped off or something, I have unloaded them.
Okay.
I worked at for a couple of months one summer up at Mill 2 helping unload box cars that had pulp in them. And I worked for about a month and a half in the summer down at Mill 1. And at Mill 2, I actually drove a forklift and helped unload the stuff. At Mill 1, there was a three-man crew that unloaded box cars because the pulp would come in. And your tractor driver would pick it up, and they were stacked five bales high in the box car.
Sure.
But the tractor there at that, they had to take the pulp out, put it on an elevator, and run it up to the next floor, and the elevator would only take a stack that was four high.
I see.
So they had a guy, you know, the tractor driver would pull a full stack out, and then he'd push it up against the wall, and then he would have to kind of stick the forks in it and
right.
lift it up part way, so he had four, and they had excuse me, they had a guy who the term was block man. You had a piece of wood made out of a 4x4. It was about 8 inches long, and when he picked that up like that, you stuck that block in there so he could back up, and then he right. could actually get his forks all the way in and take those four in and set them on the elevator.
Sure.
And then when he had four separate bales there, he'd stack those up and make another thing of four.
Right. Right.
So you had a tractor driver unloading and a block man down there on the ground floor, and then up on the second floor they had a smaller tractor that would go on the elevator and pull the stuff off. So it took three guys to unload a box car like that, you know. So I was the block man.
You were the block man. What do you remember the name of the railroad line? Was that CKNS that came through the mill? And
I never really paid any attention to that, you know.
Okay.
And the other thing is, like, I don't know who the line was, because the boxcars, you know, they had boxcars from all kinds of different companies.
Yes.
You know, because they don't really keep track of where the cars
like
are.
They still do, sure.
Yep, so I don't really know what the line was. Or
okay, anything. Okay. And how long were you in? So you did that, like, a couple of summers or something.
Yeah, for, like, a month or something like it, because I was on one job, things got slow. In Rewinder sometimes, things tended to get slow in the summer, so I'd get bumped out for 6-8 weeks.
Sure.
And I'd end up wherever.
Sure.
And so I ended up in unloading in both places. I also spent one time about 4 or 5 weeks over at the warehouse, you know, the one that's still there, that's the Epic Center now.
Yeah.
That was the shipping warehouse.
Yeah.
And I had a real interesting experience in there.
What?
The bottom level job on that is the guy that actually takes the loads and puts them onto the boxcar or onto the semi-tractor trailer. And they used a special forklift that had forks that were, like, instead of being 6 inches wide, they're, like, each fork's like 24 inches wide.
Oh.
And to save money, they had the loads were on a wooden skid on top of a real heavy piece of cardboard that they called a slip sheet. And this special tractor had a ram that went back and forth and had a clamp on it. So you run the ramp forward, and you would put your forks there, and you'd clamp onto that sheet of cardboard, and then pull it back, and it pulls it back onto those big wide forks, so you leave the skid there.
Yes.
And so you get to use that skid over again and saves money. Then you go into the tractor and you set it down. And when you learn how to do it with a little practice, you know, you would set that down and you would back up the tractor, run the ram forward at the same time. So you would leave the load there.
Yeah.
And
okay.
If you had a load of really heavy stuff, like a whole load of pan liners, you actually could just put the tractor in neutral and push out with the ram and it would shove you back underneath it. You know, and we tended to do that a lot. That was the easiest way, you know. And that's where I got into trouble because, you know, I didn't have any experience. I'd never been there. And that warehouse, we got the plastic cups that they made over in Local 1010.
Yeah.
And if you had one or two of those, it didn't make any difference. But we had one time, it was like the third day that I was there, the entire truckload was all plastic cups. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I was being careful, putting them in, setting them down, you know, backing out and running the ram forward. But since the machine's got so much power and you can't really feel what's going on, I didn't realize that I was pushing forward faster than I was backing out. So I was crushing the cups.
Oh no.
Yep. So, and whoever designed that system, a semi-tractor trailer is a certain size. It's a certain width and certain length.
Yeah.
And so the skids and the loads are they were 40 by 48, and you would put them straight here and sideways here. So you get an exact number when you
sure
when you get to the back of the truck.
Sure.
You know, the skid's right there, and you close the doors.
Exactly.
You know, so I'm putting this stuff on, and there's a guy that brings the loads to you, and I put set on this last load and backed out. And I still had the tractor. I was just in the truck. And I looked back, and there's not another load waiting for me, you know. And I yelled at the guy, and I said, you know, where's the next load? And he goes, that's it, you're done. What do you mean I'm done? I said, you're done. That's the whole load. And I go, oops. So a full load should have been all the way to the back of the truck.
Uh-huh.
And I'm still in the truck with the tractor.
Yeah.
So that means I crushed the entire load by about 10 foot.
Oh, you did.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, essentially, you could probably figure that the entire load was ruined.
Really?
Yep. So I go, You know, and I said, well, you got to tell somebody because, you know, they're going to find out sooner or later anyway.
Sure.
So I went and got the foreman, and I said, hey, you know, I messed up. I'm sorry, but, you know, you guys put me on this job with a half hour's training.
Yes.
And all that, and I thought I was doing it right, but I wasn't.
Right.
So what do we do? And the foreman come out and looked at it, and he said, too much trouble to unload it. We'll just ship it.
Really?
So they shipped it, which is, I couldn't believe that. You know, so they shipped it to the receiver knowing that the entire load is bad. So, you know, we have to pay, you know, the company pays shipping, you know.
Sure.
But it gets there, and they open it up, and if it's bad, well then, you know, we have to give them credit for the load, plus pay to have it shipped back, because they wouldn't even unload it.
Oh, you know, they wouldn't.
You know,
okay.
So, you know, we have to pay for the time for that trailer going out and then sitting there. And then when they find out it's bad and rejecting it, we have to pay for it to come all the way back. And our guys have to unload it, you know, and because the foreman said, it's too much trouble to unload it.
That's an interesting.
And that didn't seem right to me. But
situation, isn't it?
But, you know, I was the peasant and he was the foreman.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there you go.
That's what we did.
Yeah. Now, after how long were you in finishing? At mill two.
About maybe two and a half years.
Okay.
Something like that.
So now what year is it? You started in 74. You've been through the beater room, the rewinders, and in finishing. What year is it?
Okay, let me think here just for a second. yeah. 8 years. 2000, would have been about 1989.
89.
Right, okay. In there when I first started in finishing.
Sure.
Because I was there for about two and a half years.
Okay.
And then when they shut down the finishing room, that was when they finally got rid of all the finishing, you know. The only thing left was machine rooms and beater rooms and shipping.
Okay.
I got bumped into Mill 2 machine room then, and I was there for 6 months. And then I got down into Mill 2 formulating, which was part of the machine room, and I spent the last 8 years there. That's where I was when the place shut down.
I see. Okay.
So that's how I was just counting back years, you know, so.
Sure.
You know, so I ran a trimmer for a year, and then I was a tractor driver for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
And I had another interesting experience when I was a tractor driver.
Oh, what?
When they started up the second shift, they got several new people in and trained them as trimmer operators to work on the second shift, because none of the experienced trimmer operators wanted to go off days and work second shift, you know.
Oh,
so,
sure.
So all the trimmer operators are all new. None of them have more than a couple of months experience. And so, you know, I've been around, and, you know, I knew they were going to have trouble. You know, to me, things are going to happen, they're going to have trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have a foreman, because we were running three trimmers. So we had the trimmer operators, the packers, a guy that packed boxes on the skids at the end, and me, the tractor driver, no foreman. And supposedly the foreman from Wax Production was supposed to come up, check on them once in a while, and if they had a problem, they could ask him. But he didn't know anything about those operations. So if he had a real problem, he wouldn't know what to do.
Sure.
So, you know, I voluntarily went into the superintendent's office for Mill 2 Finishing, and I told him, I said, you know, you're going to have trouble, and if you guys will pay me lead man rate, which is $1 an hour more than it's $1 an hour more than the highest paying job in the department, which for me would have been about a $2 an hour raise. He says, you know, when they have problems, I'll take care of them. And he told me, well, we can't do that. And I said, well, you could. He says, well, I don't want to do that. And I said, okay. I said, you're going to have trouble. He says, well, you know, that's what we got a foreman for. He'll take care of all the problems. And I said, okay, in that case, I'm a tractor driver then. That's what you're paying for me for?
Mm-hmm.
I will be a tractor driver.
Mm-hmm.
The very first day that we were operating on the second shift, our newest trimmer was actually kind of semi-computer operated. You had to write a program in it. So you put your paper on it, and it has a backboard that comes back and forth, pushes your paper up, and you make your cuts and all that kind of stuff. So you have to write a program so the backboard knows where to stop to get the right cuts and all that. We got in there and worked for an hour and finished up the job that we're on. So ready to start the next job. You know, and I bring the paper for the next job, and the trimmer operator is standing there going, you know. And I said, what's the problem? He goes, I don't know how to write the program for the new job.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, okay. And that's all I said. And then he says, do you know how to do it? And I said, nope, I'm a tractor driver.
Oh.
You know, I'd run that trimmer for a year. I said, but I'm a tractor driver. I says, I suggest that you call the foreman down at Mill 2 Wax.
Sure.
So he did, and the foreman comes up, and he goes, I don't know how to do that. I don't know anything about it. Says, there's two other trimmer operators, but none of them know how to do it either. So they go, anybody know how to program that? And I just sat there, and I said, he says, what about you? I says, well, I'm just a tractor driver. That's what you're paying me for. And so they were down for 7 hours on that machine, lost 7 hours production time because the operator wasn't well enough trained to make the program change, you know. And second day we come in, it was the same. We got to work about 4 hours that time when that program change came up, and he still couldn't do it, so we lost 4 hours on that time.
Yes.
And then I don't know if they had somebody, I think they had somebody work overtime with him to help him do a program the next day, you know.
Sure.
But then we had one of the other trimmer operators, we had one of the older trimmers, he was cutting and something happened and he chipped the blade badly, you know.
Yes.
Which happens, you know. But so what it does is you change the blade. That's something that the operator does.
Yes.
So when he chipped the blade, he's going to change the blade. And I told him, I said, I don't really think you should do that because you don't know how to do it because he'd never done it. And I said, this is, you know, you can think of a trimmer blade as a razor blade. Because a new trimmer blade, when it goes in, it is razor sharp.
Sure.
And it's 8 foot long and probably weighs in the neighborhood of 100 pounds.
Yeah.
So, and there's nothing to hang on to. It has little threaded holes in it. You can put handles in it. But like when you're going in, if you drop it, like if you dropped it on this, it would cut that right in two.
Sure.
It would
take
your finger off just like that.
Sure.
And so I said, not safe. And so they said, well, you know, I don't want to tell the foreman that I don't know how to do it because they might fire me. This is what the operator is saying. And I said, well, it's not your fault. He said, oh, no. You know, so they call the foreman. He come up and he asked this guy, can you change that? He goes, oh, yeah, I can do it. And I said, I told the foreman, I said, no, he can't do it. Doesn't know what he's doing. He's going to get hurt. And the foreman says, well, no, he says he can do it. Let him do it. And then the foreman turned around and walked away. And I told him, I says, well, be real careful. I'm not going to watch it. But anyway, so he did change the blade.
Yeah.
And he actually got it done. But problem is that we used to reuse those blades and resharpen them in our own maintenance department.
Sure.
So you get a brand new blade, it's 8 feet long and it's like, say, a foot wide. And as you sharpen them, they get smaller.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you take a new blade off that's a foot wide, or if you take one that's been sharpened that's like 4 or 5 inches wide,
mm-hmm.
and you put an 8 foot one on, or a brand new one on that's
right.
that's 12 inches wide,
yeah.
that means if you don't make adjustments, your blade is actually like 4 inches longer than the one you took off.
That's right.
Okay, and trimmer blades, they come down at an angle like that, but they're up here and they come down and they shear through the paper,
sure.
and they stop right at the surface of the table. Yeah, I mean the table that the paper's on and all that, and it has a little wooden strip. So if it goes through its cycle and like that and stops, you know, your blade's 4 inches too long. That means it would have to go through the table 4 inches.
Yeah.
To go, and,
okay.
And so,
oh.
So he put the blade in and he just, you know, it's all set. So he hits the palm switches and it goes through its cycle and it comes down and he goes, good chunk, crunch, you know.
Oh.
And it crunches right into the table and... The motor on the machine is straining, trying to go through its complete cycle.
Sure.
And finally, and there are shear pins in there. So the pin's finally sheared, which releases the pressure on the motor. And usually about the same time it blows the fuse, you know. So they call the boss back up and he looks at that and he goes, I guess he didn't really know what he was doing, did he? So then they have to get an electrician up to change the fuse and a millwright up because this is our oldest machine. The new machines were electronic instead of mechanical.
Uh-huh.
And if it went down, and you know, you could push this button and it reversed.
Sure.
It just backed up.
Sure.
The mechanical one, it can't reverse.
It can't.
It has to go through its complete cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other, you know, there is a way to reverse it, but a millwright's got to crawl underneath the machine. And there's a shaft that turns, you know, and he has to get underneath there with a pipe wrench and manually turn that shaft backwards.
Okay.
And, you know, and it's really difficult to get it. You know, it's dirty, it's nasty, it's a small room. And when you get the wrench on it, you know, they make ratchets, you know, so you can go like that.
Yes.
You know, a pipe wrench doesn't have a ratchet. And there's no, you know, so you get up there and you got, you know, like eighth of a turn. And he's got to back it up like 4 inches. So it takes him almost 2 hours to back that thing off.
No kidding.
You know, and so, and then they took the blade off, and by that time it was almost day shift, so they let the day shift guy put the next new blade on.
Sure. Did you ever get hurt at the mill?
Oh, yeah. But you know, let me finish that. And then, so the next day, the department foreman called me into the office, and he said, what's with all this trouble these guys have been having? I said, well, you know, I told the superintendent that they just don't have enough experience, and I would be willing to help if they pay me. And just admit that they didn't know everything, that they needed help, and pay me this token, you know, $2 an hour for a 40-hour week is only $80.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was a pretty good amount to me, but to the company, that's really nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that first 4 hours, or first 7 hours of lost production time was way more than $80.
Mm.
You know, so the foreman says, well, gee, you know, I can't pay you lead man pay because that's not in the contract. He says, but we have this one machine that we run once in a while, but not all the time. It's a core operator. And says, I can just sign your time card and pay you core operator rate instead of tractor driver rate. That would be a buck and a half more. And he says, if I do that, will you help them guys out?
Yeah.
And I said, sure.
Yeah.
So we operated for another year up there. And never had any trouble. I mean, we had things that went wrong.
Yeah.
But I took care of all of them.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
sure.
That was all I asked for, and they refused to do it. And, you know, that first week showed them that sometimes you got to listen to the union people.
Yes. Yeah, that which brings up the union.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever steward or?
Ran for steward one time and got soundly whopped in the election. So I said, okay, that's obviously that nobody wants me, so.
You don't want to be steward.
So I never bothered to run again.
I see. And were you there, was there a strike when you were there?
Yep, strike was in 1986.
Okay.
I considered that to be one of my best summers because, since I was actually working, the week before the strike, the company was running full tilt trying to get as much stuff in the warehouse as they could. And I was running a small rewinder that was what we used to make crepe paper. And they run the big rolls of crepe paper down in the basement and then up here and we cut it on the rewinders. Well, they were only running the crepe machine one shift. So the day shift was pretty much eating up most of the paper. So I come in on second shift on Monday and I ran for 2 hours and I was out of paper. So there's nothing to do. Then there's 6 hours left of the shift. And so I went to the foreman and said, what am I supposed to do? And he goes, well, you can just clean up,
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind working, but I've never been much for clean up, make work, mm-hmm. get in there and scrape grease off just because there's nothing else. I said, well, you could sign my time card and let me go, so I could legally leave. I just wouldn't get paid.
Sure.
So
sure.
I did that on Monday. Tuesday, I come in and I ran for 2 hours and the same thing. I went home. Wednesday, I got smart and I called on the phone and talked to the day shift guy. I said, is there any paper for me to run?
Yeah.
And he said, no, basically not. And I said, well, check with the superintendent there. I'll just take the rest of the week off, mm-hmm. it's kind of, it's silly for me to come in, work 2 hours and go home.
Sure.
So they gave me the rest of the week off. So I only actually worked 4 hours of the week before we went on strike.
Okay.
Then we were on strike for 6 weeks.
6 weeks. What was that like? And this is like negotiations were in the summer, so it wasn't mm-hmm. like the dead of winter, right?
No, it was, I think it was like July and August.
Sure.
It was June and July or July and August, but it was okay. In that period of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it was great fun, We only had to come down on the picket line one day a week.
Okay.
For 8 hours, and my picket spot was over there in front of, where they just did a little bit of demolition, the old test station,
sure.
that driveway that goes down there to that little mm-hmm. unloading spot.
Right.
That's where I was supposed to sit for 12 hours, or
okay.
8 hours, excuse me. And
was it worth it? Was the strike worth it?
Oh, no, we lost our butts.
You did?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, basically, the company offered us a contract, and we said, this is outrageous, we won't take it. So we went on a strike for 6 weeks, and we took, they finally then took the exact same contract that we turned down the first time.
Oh, you did.
Because they just starved, the guys, too many of the guys were getting starved out.
Yep.
And it was, that was, when things were starting to get rough, that's when we started losing. Before that, we in contracts we'd get a halfway decent raise or something. Like on that contract, we ended up getting a 50 cents an hour raise and nothing else. Nothing on the pension,
no benefits or any of that kind of stuff.
And it just basically was like that for the rest of the time before they shut down. We never got anything decent after that. But it was kind of fun because you hear about strikes like in the the auto company where everything, there's all this violence and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff,
Sure.
We don't want to hurt anybody,
mm-hmm.
So we're sitting in lawn chairs out there and they had a 55-gallon drum with brought in wood and had a fire going in it, and had a cooler sitting there, which of course only had Coke.
Mm-hmm.
Because the parchment policeman would check on us every once in a while. He said,
yeah.
What do you guys got in that cooler?
Well, yeah.
Well, Coke. Except the Coke said Coors on it.
Oh, okay.
So, we sat there and drank Coors all night, but we weren't rowdy, and the police knew it, but we weren't rowdy and we didn't bother anything,
sure.
So they didn't
sure.
care.
Yeah.
As long as we weren't causing trouble, so.
Sure.
We had, so it was a good time for, that was the best summer I ever had, because, I didn't make much money, but by then, my wife had got a job and she was making more money than I was at the mill, so.
Oh, okay.
So I knew we were eventually going back to work, sure. So I wasn't worried about it.
What is, speaking of your wife, what's your wife's name?
My wife's name is Deborah.
And what was her maiden name?
Wilbur.
Wilbur?
Wilbur.
Okay.
Yep. She came from the Jackson area.
Yeah.
And her father worked for an outfit called Healthco, which was a hospital medical supply.
Mm-hmm.
And they opened up a branch here in Kalamazoo in 1970, and he got transferred here as manager of that.
Sure.
And, you know, she was going to Cal Valley, and then when she got out, she was working as a secretary at Cadillac Plastic, and that short 3 month period that I was a security guard.
Right.
I was security guard at Cadillac Plastic.
So
that's where I met her.
Yeah. How about what are your parents' names?
My father's name was Richard, and my mother's name was Helen. Her maiden name was Bentley.
Bentley.
Yeah.
Okay. And are they from here?
Not originally. My mother was born in Pikeville, Kentucky in
1924.
Mm-hmm. My dad was born in Medora, Indiana, which is about as far south and east in Indiana as you can get. It's right on the Ohio River at the south end of Indiana.
Okay.
And that was 1918. And Grandpa was a tenant farmer down there on a big farm. And in 1924, they moved from there up to Kalamazoo and got a house out on the east side of town, just across the street from the Kalamazoo Fairgrounds, down there, closer to the river.
Sure.
And okay. Grandpa got a job in the old King paper mill that used to be on Lake Street.
Ah.
But then in the late 30s, he got hurt on the job, and that was back in the days that when you got hurt on the job, you just got thrown out of the street.
Yeah.
There weren't any social programs like there are now.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My dad had to quit high school in 10th grade, and my uncle was half owner of that bakery that we were talking about.
Quality Bakery.
Yep.
In Kalamazoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so my dad went to work at the bakery washing dishes, you know, starting out.
Sure.
And ended up working there for 50 years, you know, and became a master baker, which really aren't very many of those around anymore, you know.
I wouldn't think. Yeah.
And so, you know, he was really good at it. And so
yes.
That's where they, you know, so that's what. Yeah, he was working there when they did
that. They bought the parchment paper that the mill made. Yeah.
They did the testing, and then they, of course, bought it because, you know, pretty much every big bakery in the country bought it once it came out because that stuff really worked.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
It was that popular. It
yep.
just got everywhere.
Mm-hmm. It was one of the biggest products that they sold.
It was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Parchment paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what they called it, didn't they? They call it baking paper? What did they call it?
It was parchment pan liners is what they called it.
Okay. Parchment pan liners. All right.
Because basically, you know, you have this, the standard size baking pan is like, I think it's like 18 by 24 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So your piece of paper is cut just an eighth of an inch less than that, and it perfectly lines the pan.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Have you lived in Mattawan your entire life? Or
I was born in Kalamazoo. Lived in Kalamazoo until I was 19. Then lived in various places for the 3 years that I was in the Army.
Okay.
And then I came back to Kalamazoo and lived there and bought my first house there. And then about 18 years ago, we sold that house and moved out to Mattawan to be out in the country.
Yep.
Got tired. I kind of lived right downtown.
Oh.
And just got tired of being downtown.
Sure.
You know, so we moved out into the country.
Sure. Sure. And Jim, do you have any kids?
No children. We have big dogs. I have big Weimaraners.
Well, you do?
Yep. I got two of them right now. They're my sixth and seventh ones, and they've all come out of the Weimaraner Rescue Program.
Oh, what's that? Is it local or a national
group? There is a national group and a state group.
Okay.
And a couple of them came out of the national group. These two came out of the state group, which is run by a lady up in Lansing.
Okay.
And people have to get rid of dogs for various reasons, you know.
Yes.
And they go into the rescue group, and then they put them up for adoption.
I see.
So those are our kids.
I see.
And they're spoiled more than most kids.
And what are their names?
Kanya and Sadie.
I see. Okay. Let me ask you something that I skipped over by mistake at the mill. Do you ever play any sports? Are there any other sports teams there?
I never played on any of the teams. That stuff was kind of winding down. I'm familiar with the history of it, but it was kind of winding down by the time that I got hired in.
I see.
That was more 40s and 50s is when that was really, really big.
Really hot.
The only thing that I did was the company sponsored bass tournaments. I fished in a couple of those.
Oh.
Where, you know, they just, they paid, you know, they gave money for prizes and that kind of stuff.
They did. Where did you go fishing?
Various lakes around, like Austin Lake, Eagle Lake out at Texas Corners.
Oh, yeah? And,
yeah.
How popular were they? I mean, lots of guys would do this or not?
Oh, usually about 30 of them or so. It was a pretty good time.
Yeah.
Know? And they gave out some nice prizes and stuff like that. It was just a fun time. And
sure.
How
many years do you think they did that? Or how long did you do it?
I did it for probably, I probably did 7 or 8 of them. And
yeah.
All that stuff stopped when Crown Vantage, when we became Crown Vantage.
It did.
They cut out anything. You know, they used to sponsor bowling tournaments, golf league, the fishing. I can't remember.
Bowling? Anything. Did they sponsor bowling?
Yeah, bowling.
Bowling?
Yeah, bowling and golf, I know.
Bowling and golf, okay.
When Crown Vantage took over, they cut all that stuff. They didn't do anything like that.
Oh.
And they also gave us permission to use the land back there behind Mill 2, closer to the river,
mm-hmm.
Not too far from the water treatment plant. And we put in a trap field and shot
yes.
trap back there.
Yeah.
And that went on for about 4 or 5 years. And then the people that were running the program ended up all being on one shift. They couldn't get anybody that wanted to run on the other shifts, and so it just kind of fell through.
Yeah.
And the major expense of the thing was the mechanical thrower, you know. And the guys raised money, and we bought that ourselves. But the company let us use the land, and they furnished the building materials. You build a little block house like that.
That's right.
The house and the machine.
Sure.
And the company paid for that.
Okay.
And Millwright's actually built it, and our own electricians wired it and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
and they let us use the land.
Sure.
Well, then when it quit running, it probably sat there for about 2 years, and then that's when, you know, Barb Dignan was head of human relations or whatever.
Barb Dignan. Yeah.
They decided. Well, they'd get rid of it, so they were going to sell the machine.
Oh.
And the guys that did had done all the work found out about it, so they went over there in the middle of the night, you know, and unbolted the machine.
Really?
And absconded with it.
Ah.
And then later sold it and split the money amongst the guys that did the work.
No kidding.
Because, you know, Barb was going to sell it and put the money into the company coffers or, you know, petty cash or whatever. So,
yes.
You know, so the guys go, oh, we did all the work. If we're going to get any money, we're going to get that. So
well,
I thought that was kind of funny.
Speaking of that, I bet there were pranks in the mill.
I'm sure there were.
You didn't engage in a lot of horseplay or pranks?
Some of that. I'm just trying to think of anything in particular. Like, of course, me, I'm innocent as driven snow.
Oh, sure.
I don't know if you want to call it a prank, but, you know, when I worked on the midnight shift down there at Mill 1 in Rewinders,
yeah,
we were supposed to get a 10-minute coffee break, a 20-minute lunch break, and a 10-minute coffee break, you know, that's 50 minutes during the night.
Right.
Well, in practice, what they actually did was they combined it all together, and we just shut everything down from 3 to 4 for an hour. And the foreman didn't care because we ran the same amount of production as the other two shifts.
Oh, okay.
And one of my friends drove this huge pickup truck that had this huge camper on it, the biggest camper you can get on a pickup. So in the summer, we'd go out there and we'd have the hour in. I was the cook because, you know, I'm a good cook. We'd cook steak and eggs. You know, we'd have the three of us out there. We had 3 big steaks, a dozen eggs, and a 6-pack of beer for lunch at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Where would you cook this?
Inside this camper out in the parking lot.
In a camper?
yep. Steak,
really?
Eggs, and beer.
Wow, that's living.
And, of course, you know, you're not supposed to drink on the job.
Right.
You know. And when I first hired in 74... there was a lot of drinking.
Was there?
Yep.
You mean like out in the parking lots in their cars and trucks?
No. I mean in the mill.
In the mill. Was there? Okay.
When I started out, you know, I was in the beater room. And I was kind of nervous about doing anything because I'm a new employee and all that. You know, I didn't know anybody or anything.
Yeah.
But when you stuck, there was the, underneath where we were a broke one, up on the top floor where the beaters were, you had to go up the ramp and around the ramp and all that. And kind of the mid-level, there was what they called the hydropulper unit, which was a couple of big beaters that use water pressure. It's like a big blender, kind of. And you beat up paper and all that.
Yeah.
Well, in the summer when it was really hot and things were a little bit slow, they would take one of those. It's a 10,000-gallon tank, you know, so it's like 10 feet deep and 12 mm-hmm. feet in diameter and all that. And on the bottom, you got your blades, you know, like a blender.
Yes.
And they would fill that up with cold water and pull the fuse out of the breaker so that it couldn't be turned on accidentally, put a ladder in it, and then go swimming in that. And then when they got out, because it was really it was hot up there.
Yes.
You know, and they'd come out, you know, and then they had all these benches kind of set up, and they cracked some beers.
Oh.
And the foreman would come down and drink with them.
Oh, really?
It's not like they were trying to hide this. I mean,
right?
The foreman was right down there with them. And he didn't say it because he never bought any beer.
I see.
But he drank a lot of it.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't know if you want to call that a prank, but that was, kind of an interesting little situation. You know, and like I say, I drank beer occasionally out there in the camper when we were cooking.
Yeah.
And the first winter that I was in on the midnight shift down there, they hadn't put any new heaters in. Later on, they came in and put gas heaters that hung from the ceiling and blew hot air out. Well, when I first got there, the only heat down there in Mill 1 Rewinders was the old-fashioned steam radiators on the outside walls of the building.
Yeah, sure.
So if you're here in the center, you know, that first winter, I wore a down coat.
Sure.
You know, and you could see your breath while you were working.
Yep.
So I was core cutter helper on the machine, you know, and my friend and I, we always kept a bottle of MD 2020, Mad Dog, which is it's a fortified wine. It's 20% alcohol.
Right.
We kept that back in the core rack and take a nip on that every once in a while because it was so darn cold.
Wow. Yeah, that is cold.
Yeah, and so.
Now, you said you had gone, you came to the reunion.
Mm-hmm.
The big reunion we had in July here.
Yep.
And did you see a lot of guys you hadn't seen in a long time?
Pretty much, even though, most of us still live in the area.
Sure.
Just tend to not run into each other.
Yeah.
I'll run into somebody once in a while,
mm-hmm.
but not on any kind of regular basis, So I saw, quite a few people that I knew fairly well, including Barb Digdon, which I had to kid her because, I actually liked Barb Digdon. She was a nice person.
Yes.
But one time she called me up on the phone and fired me, and I asked her if she remembered that.
Oh.
And she didn't, of course, because, she had so much detail stuff.
Sure.
But what had happened was, it was one of those times when it got slow. I was bumped out of Rewinders up to Mill 2 Wax Production. And I worked there for like 6 weeks, and then I got called back to my regular job down at Mill 1. So I'd been working days at Mill 2 Wax, and now I'm going back to my regular job on days down there at Mill 1 in the Rewinders.
Mm-hmm.
So on Friday, I get this phone call about 4:30 in the afternoon, and it's Barb, and she says, is this Jim Crow? And I said, yep. She says, you're the Jim Crow that works at, I don't know if it was James River or Crown Vanny's back then, but whatever. Well, it would have still been James River. I says, yep, that's me. And she goes, well, okay, I just wanted to call up and let you know that you're fired. Fired?
Oh.
Says, can you do that on the phone? I says, well, I just did it.
Oh.
Oh, well, okay. Why am I fired? She goes, well, you haven't been to work all week, and you didn't call even or anything. So that's if you don't come into work and you don't call, that's called a, no call, no show.
Mm-hmm.
And in the contract, a no call, no show is a termination offense. One is a termination offense.
Sure.
I'm sure.
Well, job abandonment. That's
basically
what that is.
Yeah. So and she's saying that I've done that 5 days in a row, And I said, well, I don't think so. She goes, yep, I got it right here, And it says, Mill 2 Wax says that, you haven't been there all week. And I said, well, yeah, okay, I guess you're right. I haven't been there all week. And so if you want to fire me for that, go ahead. But I'll be down there with my lawyer Monday, and then I hung up.
Oh.
Yep, and then she calls back and says, wait a minute, what's this with the lawyer stuff? And I says, well, okay, yeah, you're right. I was not at Mill 2 in Wax Production. I was at Mill 1 in Rewinders because I got recalled.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody messed up and they put me, I was on the schedule for two different places.
Sure.
And so I'm working where I'm supposed to be. And here where I was still on the schedule. But mm-hmm. that's not my problem, you know. Mm. But they didn't catch it, so they turned me in for 5 no-call, no-shows. Right. And Barb, all she knows is what they told her.
Sure.
So she fired me.
Sure.
So then she had to apologize and rehire me.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, I never was actually fired.
Right.
You know, but
not true. Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of funny.
You know, yes.
And she laughed about it too there at the reunion. You know, she was kind of embarrassed at the time. You know,
sure.
But again, it wasn't her fault. You know. And,
right.
You know, you look back at it, you know, that kind of stuff is kind of humorous. You know.
Now it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, if we can, we're getting towards winding this up here, Jim. What you made a good living at the mill.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
I've heard lots of guys say that. Yeah, the...
Mm-hmm. You know, the benefits were halfway decent, and the pay was pretty good.
And the pay was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So, had a big impact on you and your family, you and your wife, right?
Yes, but not as much as a lot of the guys, because my situation was different. A lot of the guys were married and had children.
Sure.
You know, and if you've had children of your own, you know that they're expensive.
Yep.
You know, so like I knew a bunch of guys that had like they have like 4 kids, and the wife doesn't work an outside job; she's staying home taking care of the 4 kids.
True.
You know, but they've got a nice new home, and they've got a car for him and a car for her, maybe a car for one of the kids, maybe a boat, something like that.
Sure.
And they're doing fine, but they're making payments and all this stuff. And as long as we're working, and there's overtime available, we're doing great. Well, all of a sudden, he's not working, and she doesn't have an outside job.
That's right.
You get in trouble real quick.
Sure.
Well, in my case, I didn't have any children.
Right.
My wife was making, about the time that it became Crown Vantage, you know, which was the last 7 years,
mm-hmm.
Deb, before that, I was making more money than she was. Well, that's about where she pulled ahead of me.
Okay.
So she was actually making more money than I did, and she had good health insurance. So when the place shut down... Yeah, we lost my income, but I drew unemployment for the first year.
All right.
And I tried to find another job, but nobody would hire me because I had certain health problems.
Ah.
And so I'm telling the state that I'm out actively looking for work, and nobody will hire me. And then at the same time, I'm telling the federal government that I can't work because of my health problems, which was really true. So I ended up qualifying for Social Security disability. So the only time that money got a little bit tight was that 1 year, I drew unemployment for a year, and it took me almost 2.5 years to finally get everything all settled and actually start drawing Social Security disability.
Sure.
So that 18 months between, because I was, you know, unemployment for me was like, it was just like $325 a week or something like that.
Right.
And with no kids plus hers, you know, we didn't have any problems.
Sure.
So for about 18 months, we lost that. And that was when things were a little bit tight.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went on, I got disability, you know, disability, you know, it's just like Social Security. It's kind of based on how much you used to make, you know, and all that, you know.
Yeah.
So for me, it's $20,000 a year.
Sure.
You know, plus, and plus I also... I've been drawing military disability since 1969.
Okay.
You know, and that's another $1,500 a month, you know.
All right.
So, you know, and I got health insurance through the VA. I got health insurance through Medicare because once you're on disability for 2 years, you can draw Medicare.
Sure.
And I got health insurance where my wife works.
Yeah.
You know, so for us. And then the other thing was that, you know, everybody that had any intelligence knew that the mill was shutting down.
Sure.
You know. So a year before the mill shut down, I had a second house up north, you know, and 20 acres, and I sold that.
Okay.
And paid off every debt that we had except for the house that we live in.
All right.
And so we were debt free except for the house.
Yeah.
When the mill shut down.
Okay.
Where, you know, some of my friends, you know, they were in debt up to their butt.
You bet.
And the wife didn't work.
Yeah.
So you know, just totally different situation.
Yeah. Okay. What did we miss? We miss anything?
Not much of anything. Do you really know, did anybody ever tell you, you know, what happened and why Crown Vantage really shut down and all that kind of stuff?
No, I don't know. I'm not from here.
Mm-hmm.
And in all the oral histories I've done, I don't believe anybody said.
Because I don't know if it's all that much common knowledge because not everybody paid attention to it. But, you know, back in the 80s and the early 90s, the economy was booming. And this wasn't in Chatterton's book either, you know. He had parts of it, but the economy's booming, everything is growing, everything's doing well. James River was a small mill in Virginia. They had some excess capital, And they started buying these other small paper companies mm-hmm. and growing to be a big corporation. So eventually they reached where like they had 22 companies in the corporation and they're all running it like 100%. They're doing great because the economy is doing good. Well, late 80s, to around 1990, the economy starts tanking a little bit. And plus we were starting to feel more pressure with competition from China and from Europe. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden, all these companies that were running at 100% are now running at 60%. And so they go and they decide, gosh, we'd rather run 15 companies at 100% than 22 mm-hmm. companies at 60%. Mm-hmm. From a business standpoint, makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. But from all the people that you kill, it's terrible.
Yeah.
But so what James River did, and then there was also a second thing that happened in there. At that time, James River stock was running about $17 a share.
Mm-hmm.
And all of your big people, the chief executive officer, the CEO, the head guys on the board of directors for James River.
Yes.
They're all in their mid to late 60s. They're all sitting on several million shares of common stock mm-hmm. for James River.
Mm-hmm.
So they get their lawyers together and they do a corporate spinoff. I don't really know how that stuff works, but they take the sixth least profitable companies of James River and they set them over here and they form a new corporation called Crown Vantage. And I don't know how they do this kind of stuff because I'm not an accountant or a lawyer.
Sure.
But they take all of the corporate debt that James River has and they switch it over to Crown Vantage.
Oh.
And I don't know how that worked, but they did. And it's legal. Might not be ethical, but it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have James River sitting here. It's now a debt-free corporation. And their stock immediately doubles. It goes to $34 a share because, and all these big wigs, they all sell their stock and retire.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you think that was a coincidence?
Mm.
No, that was a planned
mm-hmm.
thing,
mm-hmm.
And us little guys who had money in the 401k stock plan, that was all set up, we were just, they took us to the cleaners because, We couldn't take advantage of that double because the only time that we could ever get rid of our stock is if you quit or retired. As long as you're working, you can't get rid of the stock.
Oh.
So there's that window when the stock, is, I'd like to sell it now. Well, you can't because you're still working.
Sure.
And then we roll over into Crown Vantage, and at that time we didn't know how things were going to go and we're hoping that, it'll take off and be good. Well, you were forced to take your James River stock and trade it for Crown Vantage stock. You didn't have any choice.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay. So all that profitable James River stock I had, now I've got all this Crown Vantage stock, which at the time is worth the same amount of money. But Crown Vantage was set up to get rid of the debt from James River. So it means they started up so far in debt that they never had a chance to stay in business.
Oh.
It was a deliberate thing to help these guys. And we don't care what happens to these guys.
I see.
So I could watch my 401k. It just, gradually started going down to where in 1999, my James River stock was worth $300,000. Because I got into it as soon as I could. I put as much money into it as I could because it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah.
When they actually went out of business, they issued me a check for the value of my stock.
Yeah.
Which I should have brought that down and scanned it for you, but I didn't.
Oh.
I got a check for 2 cents.
You did?
Yep. They had the nerve to send me a check for 2 cents.
Wow.
So I lost $300,000 there. And
wow, what a blow.
And then the first majority of the year, up until it became Crown Vantage, all the money that you put in plus the company match all had to go into company stock. Well, right about the time Crown Vantage took over, they changed that to where the company's money still had to go into company stock.
Mm-hmm.
But the dollar that you put in could go into other funds.
I see.
As soon as they did that, I put my dollar in the other funds.
Sure.
So I had $48,000 in that, which I got to take with me,
Yes.
But I rolled it over, and I don't know if you follow the stock market, but I rolled over $48,000 in the second week of December of 2000. The third week, 1 week later, the stock market tanked. And when you buy in funds like that, you buy shares in the funds.
Yeah.
Okay, so In 1 week, my $48,000 goes from $48,000 down to $23,000. Mm. You know, that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've kept that one account separate. And in 10 years, it's been back as high as 42, but it's back down to around 36 now.
Yeah.
It's terrible now. And I also, my wife has a 401k, and hers did the same thing because of the stock value.
Sure.
And I had another investment program that I was in that was there. You know, like, so I was sitting there at 1999, you know, I had $500,000 bucks. With the way things were going,
right.
We were figuring that by the time I got to 65,
right.
That was going to at least double, probably a little bit more. So the theory was that I was going to have $1 million when I was 65 to retire on.
Yeah.
Okay, I got about $180,000 now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a considerable difference.
Life has certainly changed, mm-hmm. in the last decade in this country. Yes. Yeah. Well, Jim, thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. And it was nice talking to you.
For sharing. Nice to talk to you. Everybody has a different story. That's mm-hmm. what's
interesting
about doing this and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.